In a way, this is a sort of a posthumous summary, a comment on the course that's come already. We've looked at a lot of the different approaches. We've looked at phenomenology, we've looked at psychology, we've looked at anthropology, and different issues that are raised by them. And it just occurs to me at the end to address the issue from a different perspective. When Peggy said, "Oh, why don't you do course on this and try and focus a little bit perhaps more on contemporary thinkers, people who've added on to the classical theories, that would be good." So it's not just, if you see what I mean, that old Daniel Powell's Freud, Durkheim, Marx, etc. model, but some of the more recent people who are working in the area. She also said it would be good to have someone do this who has some sense of actual religious studies applications. So how this actually looks when you try and study other cultures, and not just as a theoretical practice of looking at how we've seen religion. It's certainly easy to do the Daniel Powell's path, Freud, Marx, Durkheim, Eliade, Otto, etc., without ever engaging really with any of the religions. And it can be the case that the study of religion ends up doing that sometimes. So she said, "Oh yes, it'd be great if you engage with that." Of course, it can be hard to do that. Partly because we always run out of time, and also partly because it's so much a Western-dominated study. There are rarely, if you're talking about theory, theoreticians, theorists from the other cultures that you can make reference to. Even poor Edward Said, actually, after Orientalism was published, people looked through his biography and said, "Hold on, you're a really middle-class Westernized guy. How are you speaking for the other?" So these issues, kind of are raised. And I just want to look at that a little bit. Given the critique of the study of religion as Eurocentric, Western-centric, Christocentric, certainly Semitocentric, and shaped by the assumptions of the Western natural and human sciences. So we talk very much about how the study of religions is something that doesn't even seem, arguably, doesn't even seem to exist apart from as a modern phenomenon that comes in the wake of the Enlightenment's ideas of objective scientific knowledge, sort of acquisition of that knowledge through programmatic study. If that's how we see the study of religions implicitly from the start, as part of a secularized research agenda, then it's interesting that while people have complained about this profusely, and I've quoted quite a lot from the Critical Terms in Religious Studies book and the Routledge Guide to the Study of Religions and the Insider-Outsider Debate book by edited by Russell McCutcheon, and another one I can't remember, the Cassell Guide to the Study of Religions. And they're all really good collections of recent work. Another one is In Magic Still Dwells. I think that was really interesting, which is on comparative religion and whether it has a future. And they all complain again and again about how the study of religions is totally westernized. Can we ever hope to use these categories to understand indigenous ideas? Pass, yeah, thank you. Oh, yeah. Can we ever hope to understand indigenous ideas using these Western categories? Strikingly, most of the people who do make those complaints seem to show very little interest in actually going and studying the other religions. I may be wrong about that, and I look at some exceptions, but I think a lot of these people who do the theory of the study of religions write extensively, like Jonathan Zee Smith in his essay Religion, Religions, Religious, writes extensively on the history of how this idea has arisen, but isn't interested in writing on the aspects of the idea of religion that come from other religions. And actually, that is quite important. I'm gonna use study of Indian religions to some extent today, because that's probably what I know best. But that, for instance, has been extremely important. What the Indian idea of religion is has been extremely important in determining, for instance, the German idea of religion as a category. You see it in Rudolf Otto, you see it in Eliade, you see it in Max Müller, even Freud. For a lot of those people who were developing the early study of religions, actually, Hinduism was the other religion, and maybe Buddhism, thanks partly to Schopenhauer and thanks partly to the German tendency at that time to want to study India. They're very good travelers, the Germans. And yet that isn't much paid attention to, if you see what I mean. It's still that religion is the construct of a, often Protestant research agenda that draws from the Enlightenment primarily and not from very much else. So in theory, you could say it's our job to fix this. The people who are both attending to the broader theoretical issues of what religion is, what religious affiliation means, whether it's a sociological group activity or a private experiential quality of your perspective, whatever it is, all these kinds of questions, the people who are attending to those questions but also have a non-Western pool of data to draw on, which is what so many of the people writing on the subject don't have, maybe it's their job, i.e. our job, to try and offer another model. Or at least, as we go along, to try and do work that actually improves the problematic model that we've inherited, and not just sit there and deconstruct it endlessly, because after a while that's kind of counterproductive, I think. So there's been little attempt to discover or generate a non-Western approach to the study of religions, for various reasons. What would it look like to try and reconstruct, recreate a non-Western study of religions? How could we repair the bias that haunts all current methodology in the field? Well, one of the things that people have done to try and deal with this, to try and bring the religions into the study of religion, is to look at what would be the equivalent concepts in the other religions. And here, feel free to jump in and help me with this, because my knowledge of the wider knowledge of the traditions is okay, but not fantastic. So, for instance, it's a contrast to Jonathan Zed Smith's Religions, Religious book, when Gavin Flood, in Beyond Phenomenology, Rethinking the Study of Religion, writes similarly a chapter on the idea of religion. He says, an important question here is whether the term religion has semantic equivalents in other languages and cultures. Some, such as Michael Pye, citing examples from Japan, have argued that there are such parallels, while others, such as Fritz Stahl, would wish to restrict the use of religion to Western monotheisms. Perhaps it's fruitful to look at the problem the other way around. Are there English semantic equivalents of terms indigenous to other cultures, which denote certain kinds of discourse and practices concerned with social ethics, transcendence, narratives, and ritual? He looks at some Hindu terms. He says, although textual study of their particular uses would need to be undertaken, the terms Shasana, Mata, Agama, and Siddhanta might be loosely rendered as teaching, Amnaya as tradition, Darshana as critical worldview or philosophy, Vada as discourse, Shastra as science or discipline, Marga as way or path. And he goes on to talk about these and analyzes them in particular contexts. And it occurs to me that we ask what would be the value of doing that. Well, it helps if you know the terms, but for instance, I put dharma. In many cases, I think when I go to India, the way that people will talk about religion is as dharma. Literally, that's the word that's used, and they'll talk about the Muslim dharma, or they'll talk about the Hindu dharma, or the Buddhist dharma. And it's interesting then to do some sort of term analysis of other terms that are used for a religion to try and find out what exactly it is that's being changed in there. Dharma is interesting because, like, say, Sharia has many, many meanings, famously, but like, say, Sharia, it both means what is the case and what should be the case. It captures up that aspect of religion which both describes how the world is, religion is a metaphysics, and also prescribes how the world should be. It's always an ethical, a prescriptive description. And this is something, of course, that Clifford Geertz brings up quite strongly, perhaps because he's a man who does, in fact, study Islamic societies and is aware of Sharia, but he talks about worldviews as a model of and a model for. So it's interesting how you'll get a connection there that draws out part of our idea of religion. Darshana is interesting. Darshana is often used in the Indian tradition as a view. Famously, people talk about the Sad Darshanas as the six philosophical systems. Actually, there are more than that. But of course, the word itself, where it's taken to mean philosophical system, actually literally comes from the root drish, to see. It's a viewpoint. It's literally a translation, in a sense, of perspective, of worldview. And so it's interesting, again, to see what kind of parallels you get, but also what alterations. Vada is speech, if you like, a saying, very similar to the way that we use logos or ology at the end of many terms. And so you'll find a science, a speech of a certain perspective, marga, way, a path. Each one can be analyzed for what it says about religion. Is religion a model of and for things, dharma? Is it a particular viewpoint? Although with darshana, you do get that visual imagery where it incorporates an acknowledgement of a certain relativism in perspective. One of the nice things about the sadarshanas is that they actually allow for intrinsically the idea that each person has a different viewpoint. Everyone knows the story of the sort of classic Indian story of the six blind men and the elephant, you know, and each one feels a different part. Well, in some ways it's kind of interesting because people in the West may go on writing long essays about truth claims and relativity of truth claims and how to negotiate truth claims between different religions as a view of the world, whereas actually perhaps in other religions you may find that people have already dealt with issues to do with relativism, with perspectivalism, actually with a lot of the kind of epistemological issues that are raised in the European Enlightenment at a relatively late stage. Marga, path to follow. Practice comes into a lot of it. Vada, speech, comes into a lot of it. The idea that religious views are developed through discourse, through preaching, through kind of propagation of ideas in a social context, comes up in a lot of these. And one of the points I think that's often made when people start to look into other traditions, not all of them, but often, especially in anthropology, I think in India as well, people will talk about how religion has internally, in other cultures, often been defined according to practice and not just according to creed. That's often said, isn't it, that the West focuses on doctrine, whereas in other cultures you may practice your doctrine rather than writing it down and professing it. In the way that we tend to think of as being quite crucial in Western religion, a confession of a doctrine. A lot of cultures, people won't have thought about doctrine, and theology doesn't have the same place. But of course, anthropologists working on ritual in Africa, for instance, have gone a long ways towards trying to adopt our attitude to religion as lived, as practiced. And in fact, that has gone over and been applied from the African context to, for instance, Protestant contemporary Christianity, people who say, we're looking at a lot of Christians who don't know the creed, who don't read the Bible, and who don't think about predestination or transubstantiation or any of these kinds of issues, but they practice their faith in quite a different way. It ties in very much, I think, with things said by Phillips, things even said by Don Cupid, that kind of analysis which looks at meaning as a form of life. That's often said to me when I ask what Hinduism is. People will say it's a way of life. It's not a religion. The word religion hasn't actually completely mapped itself correctly over. Equivalents in other cultures would be interesting to look at, I think. In Buddhism, for instance. I think I always, whenever I teach Buddhism, I'm fascinated by the terms Mahayana and Hinayana, and you explain to people it's a vehicle, it's the great vehicle and the lesser vehicle, and you have this image of everyone getting into a vehicle and the vehicle taking off through history. There's something actually about that which I think has something interesting to say about affiliations. It's you enter into a collective cultural entity, as it were, which will then take you in a certain direction. You may get on or off that vehicle at different times, but it's the sense of a tradition, the sense of a dynamism, the sense of choosing to become part of this kind of changing directed tradition as collective community, I think is quite strong. And it's interesting to look at how the Buddhist idea of the yana, of the vehicle, is quite different, I think, from dharma as something which simply is and is eternally, in a slightly different way, I think. You could look almost within cultures and see how the protest movement that people elect to enter will be seen quite differently from the existing tradition and its existing set structures. And actually, that kind of contrast can be very fruitful for understanding how other cultures have seen what we think of as religion. If religion is partly something where we can identify it as contrasted with other views, so it's something that comes out of an awareness of pluralism, for instance. If the West has seen religion often as something that you elect, you choose, then you can look at instances of election in other cultures. And there's a very interesting, you know, for this purpose, there's an interesting essay in, I think it's the Insider-Outsider Debate by book edited by McCutcheon, by Ninian Smart. I remember looking at it and thinking, gosh, what has Ninian Smart got to say at this quite late stage? He's written so much already. What's he got to say about the Insider-Outsider Debate? And he simply wrote an essay, actually, where he looked at Buddhism and how it viewed the bhakti traditions which arose within Buddhism. And how the Buddhist context itself saw this new religion. What terms did it use? How did it approach it? How did it conceptualize a religion within itself? In a way, it's a very useful way to look at how, quote-unquote, religion is constructed in other cultural contexts. One of the things it shows, of course, is it's like Max Muller said, to know one is to know none, as it were. Any culture where it knows no plurality often has not thought about, if you like, the meta issues of what that religion is. It's where you find plurality within a single culture that you get people, in fact, having to ask questions about what are differences between creeds, differences between ways of life, what the nature of choice, of conversion, of belief is, for instance. You can imagine the issues that arise in a culture where no one has ever had to make a choice about what they believe to be right, and suddenly a protest movement arises and offers that choice, and suddenly, if you like, there's a whole new discourse about internal decision making, internal sympathies, how do you feel, and also potentially other aspects of how you make that choice. But historically, I think it's quite interesting to look at how what we think of as the arisal of quote-unquote religion and ideas of religion come out of particular situations. I've just put you could do similar sort of questions in I think all the traditions. In Islam, I think it's very interesting to look at things like the Shahada, how you become a Muslim. You confess your faith in Allah and in the Prophet, and that makes you a Muslim. Mm-hmm. How you become a Muslim, how you become part of a religion in itself, I think is quite fascinating. I think you have to confess it in the presence of other Muslims. But something about making a statement of commitment to key points as the thing that brings you into a community is quite fascinating. And in a way, of course, it's, I think, much closer to the Western model, that statement of agreement with certain propositional statements is very much what we think of as a creed. But it'd be interesting to study how that works. I'm always fascinated, for instance, in Islam, if you read the Quran, and I was looking at texts on Abraham, it's said again and again, of course, Abraham isn't, in a sense, Muslim because he comes before Muhammad. And the Quran is forever talking about the idea that yet he was a Muslim because he was a natural monotheist. He was, and the term that's used again and again is that he was Hanif, he was Hanifa. He was, and wonderful translation, he was upright. He was an upstanding. He had the correct disposition towards God. He was an upright man. What that, and then that term will be extended to say, well, actually, anyone who's Hanifa is a Muslim, is in a sense part of this religion. To look at what that means, disposition, indeed a disposition towards the idea of God and of the world, that's what it takes to be part of a religion. It appeals to me because I love philosophy and I'm always interested in that sort of ideological dimension. But it's also, I think, just generally interesting. It's quite a different designation from, say, religion as practice. Arguably, well, maybe it is exactly religious practice, but it offers interesting questions. Muslim, I put that, the idea of submission as the core of becoming part of religion. And again, in Islam, how you look at pluralism, people of the book, it speaks again and again about the people of the book as opposed to the polytheist, what it means to be of the book. Here we have a designation of religious affiliations based on some particular artifact, actually, a particular historical entity, the book. And if you are a religion of the book, you go along with this book, then suddenly you are part of a particular group. That affiliation is there and encircles you in a certain way. Again, a very different way of defining what it is to be part of that group, to be affiliated to that religion. It's no longer about a particular creed. It's about association to particular historical flags, if you like, of a tradition. And of course, of the book, you think of the book as an artifact, as a main thing, and in fact, for many people, the book would be an oral tradition, the people of a particular oral tradition, being told particular stories, identifying with a particular history. There's a lot, I think, that could be brought out of that to try and illuminate how people think of religion itself. So, part of the conclusion from that is that you could, in theory, build a new model of religion based on, if you like, sort of global concepts. You could rebuild the theory of religion using ideas taken from the different traditions. Just as we study how concepts of creed and confession, church as concrete and spiritual community, a Pauline view of love as an internal state of mind, all of these are an important part of Christianity's idea of religion, so you could do the same with the building blocks of religion in other traditions. And again, truth discourse, for instance, that involves looking at the meta concepts that are involved in the study of religion. When you do the study of religion, what are the issues that we deal with? Propositional discourse, truth claims, spiritual practice, spiritual inner states, controversially, if one can talk about them, tradition and tradition identity, tradition affiliation being determined by the tradition, belief, faith, states of mind, for instance. I still mean to, for instance, on this point, write a book that would look at as an Indian concept of rasa. Rasa is kind of it's the emotion. It starts with the emotion that you feel when you're compelled by anything in the arts or in your relationships. If you take that emotion and you refine it, so let's say I really love a particular film and I get a strong emotion from that film. Actually, most of the Hindi cinema that I watch is premised actually on this idea that you get strong emotions. So if you watch a lot of these films, everybody's crying, oh my God, it's incredibly intense emotionally. But it's something very sort of Aristotelian happens at that moment where it's supposed to, you're supposed to refine that emotion. You're supposed to elevate it so that what you love is not just the film, what you're enjoying is not just the film, but you're enjoying the emotion itself. It's almost there's a dialectical process. And so the emotion itself then becomes a thing that you value, that you admire, that you seek, and on which you can write philosophically, and which in the Hindu bhakti devotional traditions becomes a subject of theology in itself. To acquire the rasa is to acquire devotion to God, is to, in a sense, become one with God. You enjoy God through the rasa, but God enjoys you and enjoys himself. It's very, very Spinozist in a way. Through this joining relationship of appreciation, which has been refined and valued in itself. It seems to me there's something about that which is very pertinent to the nature of religious belief, where it does involve profound emotion. I think that emotional aspect of religion and religious belief has rarely been given very much attention. In philosophy, people are coming closer to that. People like Martha Nussbaum, even Simon Blackburn, there's a trend to talk about the passions more. But actually, in study of religious belief, I think people are still very uncomfortable about it. So people like D.Z. Phillips will talk about the picture theory of religious belief. And Geertz will talk about moods and motivations. But people won't talk very much about why it's compelling, why it's powerful, and what it means for people to feel strong, love, whatever, other feelings in the context of their religious experience. So possibly things here that could improve the existing model, that could add something to the model that we have that's based only on Western concepts so far. I put other examples. Skillful means in Buddhism. could illuminate the idea of religious language as an efficacious tool rather than just a conveyor of truth. It's often true, isn't it? People will... I was just teaching the ontological argument the other day. And of course, if you study it as an argument, yeah, I think it's absolutely conceptually fascinating. It doesn't necessarily work. And it then gets criticised and pulled apart. And in fact, Richard Dawkins in his book laughs at St. Anselm because he precedes his explanation of the ontological argument with a prayer. And then afterwards he finishes it with a prayer. And of course, for him this is a weakness, but Anselm himself has said to study God is to worship God. There is something of practice in here. And so that actually maybe the propositional claims that are being made in this argument should be tempered with something like an idea of skillful means. Where does it get your mind once you finish trying to think through this funny little logical conundrum?
Mm-hmm. Is that legitimate in the sense that you can go, right, I'm going to think about Anselm through skillful means?
Not through skillful means. And that would sound, I agree, that would sound rather silly, although... I think it's frustrating for a lot of students because they'll think, oh, I'm reading this text and actually it relates to what I read the other day in my Islam class, but this is a Buddhist text, but I'm not allowed to make that connection because I will sound like a complete wacko. But that means that there's no intermediate set of terms where you said, what I've learned from this Buddhist text, actually, I can now turn into a general theory which I can test against other things without having to refer to the Buddhist context so I don't sound like a wacko anymore, if you see what I mean.
Sounds quite dangerous.
I think it is dangerous, but I also think it's necessary, and because actually with all the terms that we use to analyse, say, say my Islamic text over here, all the terms I'm using to analyse it come from Christian cultural tradition. And a million essays being published at the moment will make this point quite strongly. We continue doing this, and then we criticize it, but we feel very uncomfortable about taking insights that could come from other religions, turning them into a broader terminology and using them. But how else on earth will we ever actually manage to get over that bias?
Don't you risk looking like Jonathan Z. Smith and writing an entire book where you go, well, we've got a mad guy who's wearing a funny coloured hat, and then a book 2,000 years ago about funny coloured hats. Let's make a point when there's no connection.
But wouldn't that be the wrong way to do it? I mean, if I say, the Buddha said of skillful means that it was this, therefore Anselm looks like this, that would be silly. That's looking at the particular instance and applying it to another particular instance. That's why it's actually much harder, and we need a whole movement in the study of religion which says, forget the comparison for now. Let's form the theories. Let's develop a set of theories. What would skillful means to tell us about religion in the Buddhist context? Is it the case that sometimes apparent truth claims are actually meant to be effective, efficacious in some way? And that's actually, this is said in certain Western contexts, but this could help that theory. Once I've developed the theory that doesn't anymore make reference to the Buddha's particular set of terms, but looks at actually how often many spiritual leaders will say at some point down the line, what I'm saying to you isn't exactly right, but I want to show you that if you reach the point at which you've assimilated the effect of this, then a kind of truth, a kind of appropriateness to the new world view will be revealed to you. Once we've established that, we've looked at it on a wider range of fronts, we can say, is this true of Anselm?
But is that? But wouldn't you leave yourself still open to, like the way that we look at Otto and stuff and go like, aha, closet theologian. Isn't someone just go, she's just being a secret Buddhist in everything she's written?
But at the moment we're all being secret Christians. How is that?
But then, that's what I mean, it's still not going anywhere. We're just going to go around putting on different...
Well, I'm not from a Christian background, so what am I supposed to be? I'm from a non-religious background.
I think Smith is wrong in that to take an idea... What's your data set? You take your data set, you form theories based on it, and then you use the theories. It doesn't make you a Christian, but it means that your theories are based on data which have a particular set of things associated with them, a particular formation. That's fine. That's how you get theory. But surely in any subject, you broaden your theory base as much as possible. If you base your idea of what an animal is purely on vertebrate mammals, you'll get a limited idea of what an animal is. You need to go study the amphibians as well, and the birds, but you know, all the other things, invertebrate birds flying around in floppy weather. You know, I don't think that means that we become crypto-Buddhists or crypto-anything. It means that we should have it. I can't see any way that it could make any sense not to have a theory of religion based on all the religions rather than just on one. I can't see how that could be problematic. I don't really see why it's weirder, why it's methodologically more problematic than just basing it on Christianity and a little bit of Judaism.
But wouldn't you create a new worldview?
Maybe,
any religion. If you say, well, I can't compare this argument, Christian argument with a Buddhist argument, I have to find a sort of third position. That third position would be a different worldview.
Put it this way, I don't think I mean that what we're doing here is just comparing. That's like saying, here's a picture of the Buddha, and here's a picture of the Virgin Mary, and let's look at whether or not they're the same. That's a slightly different practice. What we do is we look at the picture of the Buddha, and we say, how does this work? What are the different ways in which this signifies? What are the different things it's trying to do for the believer? What kind of semiotics is going on here? What's its relation to the tradition of Buddha images, etc.? And we say, all of this contributes to our theory of what religious images can do and the different kinds of religious discourse. Now, we need some more data, because a theory is going to be better, in a way, with more of that data. Let's look at the Mary image. What does that do for its believers? Oh, something different than for the Buddha image. Okay, that's interesting. And, you know, what effect does it have on its believers? So in some ways quite similar, but in these ways quite different. What you'll end up with, what you're aiming for, is not to show how they're the same and how they're different in itself. What you're trying to do is get an idea of what images do and can do for believers. And you end up with a theory. And the theory may be a complex theory. You're certainly not trying to reduce all the data. But if your question in the study of religion is, how do non-verbal expressions of faith relate to the contents of religious doctrine, or how do they relate to theology, then surely the point is to use instances of this in religion to refine that theory, to answer that question. If we implicitly only ever use Christian images, then we haven't produced a theory of how this works in religion. We've produced a bit of Christian theology. Well, not Christian theology, but the history of Christianity.
Doesn't John Hick attempt to do some of this stuff, doesn't he?
I think he does, yeah.
Not
although
very successfully, maybe, but...
Yeah, I mean, part of my problem with Hick is that he always has in the back of his head an idea that they're all going to turn out... You know, he kind of feels that he's got a metaphysics, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I think his Kantian metaphysics often gets in the way. I think we could do the study of religions producing good theories without necessarily having an affiliation to one religion or the other, without necessarily imposing too much, offering models that may or may not be applicable in other contexts. What would be bad is if I developed the skillful means model, said this is how religious discourse works, and then forced it onto Anselm. But if it's one of many tools that I have that's improved my idea of the ways in which religious discourse can work, that I can accept or reject, then I've only benefited, as far as I can see, as long as I don't use it irresponsibly.
Yeah, because the sort of model you're talking about there is basically a phenomenological model. You could equally build a psychological model for all those religions, maybe a sociological model for all those religions, so it's a big undertaking that you're into there, if you want.
Yeah, I think that's... But I also think it's implicitly what we're already doing.
Yeah.
You know, I think that we all know that we're not really supposed to just take the notion of Christian creed or Christian models of prayer and use that as the way that we look at prayer in, you know, Hinduism or whatever. We know that we're not supposed to do that. We know that we're supposed to come back with an idea of actually how prayer works slightly differently in a, you know, whatever, puja context or something. We know that we're doing that. It's just that no one says it and puts it into larger terms. And no, people don't necessarily come back and say, therefore, by the way... we've refined our idea, or we've diversified our idea of what prayer is. And that's not a bad thing. And that may be useful. In fact, in practice, it is often useful later. So, for instance, arguably, Clifford Geertz's notion of Sharia has, in fact, contributed to his idea of how worldviews work. And the same thing's been said in respect of Dharma. Just an example of this, there's a Hinduism book series where actually I looked at them, seven or so publications, each one in the context of just studying something within Hindu culture also says along the way, has a paragraph in its conclusion where it says, and we've changed a broader idea of what happens in the study of religion. So, for instance, there's a book on Vedanta that looks at how theology and philosophy were integrated in the Hindu context that is also trying to say something about how theology and philosophy interact in general, can interact in general. The idea of the idea that they are more integrated with each other than is often revealed in the West, where we have an ology, as it were, or an osophy that is supposed to delineate two separate activities. Someone has written about how Mimamsa, so Hindu linguists, if you like, debated with Buddhists in long ago, and have said, look, if we understand how debate works in these other contexts, we can see how actually truth claims were viewed and moderated in other contexts, and we can get a much better understanding of this conflict of truth claims issue that is still dogging and haunting the whole study of religions. Gavin Flood's book, The Tantric Body, very much tries to use how in the tantric tradition people make their views real through a change to the actual physical being that they have. And it's said that often this is true. It's fitting in very much with what anthropologists have said in other contexts, that we make through our body our affiliation to a religion, often not through any particular set of beliefs that we've reflected on in great detail. We become part of a tradition. I mentioned the Indian Smart essay and the references given there. Janardhan Guneri, I think, has actually looked at... He wrote a book recently on subjectivity, I think, and memory. And he's a philosopher from an Indian background who works in a Western context, very much an analytic philosopher, but who does analytic philosophy then back of Indian religions, Indian philosophy, sorry, and has used the Indian philosophical perspective on what would be phenomenology to try and refine the concept of subjectivity in general across both traditions. You then take that concept of subjectivity and reuse it. You feed it back in to try and do a better kind of phenomenology. And Benjamin Caleb Ray in A Magic Still Dwells has used the idea of African ritual, has looked at it, how much it has affected our notion of the performative theory of religious truth. And actually, I think that's one example where it really has. People are writing differently about Christian ritual thanks to what anthropologists have written about when they go to Africa and watch, some witchcraft rite being enacted. So what would it mean to study religion in the other traditions? So that's one way to do it, is to look at the meta issues and find out how they can be refined. Another issue, I think, that arises and that's very pertinent, very, very urgent, is to say, wait a second, is there already the study of religion itself in the other traditions? How have other cultural traditions never actually looked at a range of religions and tried to understand them? And what part of what's interesting about that is asking, what would it mean to do that? What is it that we would be looking for? It begs the question of whether we cannot find the study of religion elsewhere because we define it in terms of strictly Western phenomena. So you can say, in other cultures, where have they studied a range of religions? Often if you get travellers travelling through other lands, you'll find people who end up commenting in an interesting way upon quote-unquote other cultures, an almost ethnographic approach. Often people say one of the earliest comparative religionists is Herodotus. Become quite trendy to sort of say this because it sounds like it gives it a wonderful ancient history, but in some ways that's right. If you look at Ibn Battuta, who's the Muslim who travelled through many different lands, and he writes about creeds that he finds in each place, totally not with objectivity, but yes, as a process of documenting and trying to analyse what's going on in these other contexts. It does raise the issue if we then say, yeah, but he's not objective, he's not trying to evaluate them on an equal scale. Why would people do that? You know, it's a very, as we've talked about, and this comes up again and again, it's a very Western idea that we should have an objective position and look down upon an array of other possibilities and analyse them equally. And of course, this has been connected to secularism and the idea of a secularism as establishing a neutral public space in which we can look onto worldviews without having a worldview of our own. Is it then unreasonable to ask for this in other traditions? Do we need to bring into our concept of study the idea that actually in other contexts people have done research into the religions around them? You look at any pluralistic society through history, and that's many. That could be Africa, that could be India, that could be much of Asia, that could be ancient Greece. And we'll see that they are indeed making account of, learning about and making account of the creeds around them, always from within a particular perspective. But of course, we kind of debated this in a previous class. What I think for a lot of people until recently, and even now it's being questioned, what would it mean to be outside of a particular perspective? You know, we've kind of gone full circle to saying, oh no, perhaps you're right, there isn't a God's eye point of view. So it'd be interesting, I think, to look at what, for instance, interfaith dialogue, perhaps what debate was. There's a certain honesty, I think, that you can feel when you look at Buddhists, Hindus of different sects, and perhaps even the atheist materialists in India, all coming together and arguing about doctrines and creeds and practices. You see, actually, that's where they are understanding the difference of their perspective. They are formulating truth claims, opposing them, making decisions about them. Theology, philosophy is happening in that context. It's kind of interesting to see how it happens in that way. And maybe that's a useful way in which to get a picture of what's going on in terms of the formulation of definite religious ideas and separate identities. Did you have a... No, you went.
No.
Okay, so you were. Okay. Of course, psychologists, sociologists, anthropologists, phenomenologists, archaeologists, historians, philosophers of other cultures within other religions. That would be, I think, very interesting as well. Where are the psychologists within Chinese culture, say? Where are the psychologists within Arabic culture? Should we say that there aren't any, because psychology is a particular form of study within a particular set of disciplinary categories? Or, in fact, are there some? Many people will argue that within Confucianism and within Taoism, there's a kind of psychology that's going on, that they're very psychologically sensitive religions. And what then are, if you look at them and read them phenomenologically, using their own terminology, trying to understand what they're doing from the inside, are you going to generate, as it were, a psychology of religion to some extent here?
What do you mean, kind of secular understanding of science for that?
Well, this is the question. But if we're only going to find the study of religions where there is a secular sphere and a concept of science, then we're not going to find them because they are by definition Western. We're only going to find them, in fact, I was on the internet just an hour ago looking at universities around the world to see where they have study of religion courses. And of course they have them in every colonized country. They have them wherever there is a colonial substructure because it's something that's specific to the West. You know, so do we really want to be doing a study that is specific to the West?
But wouldn't we, like, for example, there's you can do medicine based on the Quran.
Mm-hmm.
I know in Germany you can even do courses where you learn that.
Yeah.
But would we still call it medicine? Do you know what I mean? Because we'd say, well, they're healing people with the Quran, you know. Quranic verses or whatever. So
I think it's a good question, and it's exactly the question we have to answer. Medicine's slightly different because medicine, of course, isn't just aiming at understanding, it's aiming at practical results. And so you might want to say no if it doesn't produce the results. But whereas any subject that is, in a sense, aimed at understanding, I think it's a question we have to ask. If what we're doing is trying to understand, what does the study of religions do? Is it trying to understand religions? Does that mean that it can only admit data or information or insights from contexts where people are taking an objective view? Or do we actually, in order to get an understanding of religion as a whole, wherever it occurs and in whatever form, and not just in this limited pool that we're going to end up sort of limiting ourselves to, are we willing to try and engage with other radically different ways of doing it? Because I do think that we have to understand that somewhere down the line that the objective scientific view is very particular to us, I say, to a particular sort of European-American perspective. And if the study of religion wants to say, now we see the situation, we're going to make a decision once and for all, we're just going to do that, then that's fine. Then we're clear. And we can stop bothering or pretending to try and account for those other views. But let's be clear, if we do that, and I don't think everybody would want to necessarily, I think a lot of people would want to say, okay, actually, the study of religion's often been done through other perspectives, by dispute, as an interfaith dialogue, but from within. And maybe we should take that into account in understanding how religion... to understand religion, we'd have to understand that about it if we're looking at it in those contexts. So to some extent it's up to us. But I think if we're serious about learning about it in that culture, we would have to take on board, at least to some extent, that that's what they're trying to do. I think a doctor wouldn't be interested in Quranic medicine, but I think a historian of... someone who studies the history of medicine would be interested, if you see what I mean.
Mm.
Is there a difference?
Well, there are some doctors who are interested.
Yeah, okay, yes, exactly. Yeah, be careful what I say.
Well, in fact, like, we have in India, some scholars called Oxford are working on rebirth.
Yeah.
And there's a lady who's taken 3 births in the Brahmin families, and she's almost like 60. She's a bureaucrat's wife.
Mm-hmm.
So the other day we had almost all doctors, psychologists, everybody sitting on the panel and discussing a case.
Yeah.
So it was
people
interconnected.
Do.
Yeah, they are
doing
here.
Yeah, people
yeah.
do
Beijing
open up. Exactly. Well, it's an issue to take into account.
Is that, I think another question is knowledge all that we're interested in?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying that's a small thing to be interested in.
Yeah.
If you're looking at the psychology of religion,
yeah.
And that's about, does it work and how does it work?
Yeah.
And what's it really doing for us
yeah.
as individuals? So that's to do with the process of transformation
yeah.
that happens in someone as part of their practice.
Yeah. I
which
think
is which is a practical thing really.
Yeah. I think that's right, and I think that we should be more aware, not ashamed of admitting when the study of religion is applied. Of course, there's an objective side to it, but there is an applied side to it. In many respects, and sometimes that applied side is, I want to understand religion so that I can apply it to my own life better. In which case, it may be terribly useful to understand the degree to which study of religion is from a particular perspective when you do it, and won't necessarily always manage to stay in that objective bracketing of your particular affiliations. That might be quite an important thing to perceive when you see it not as putting something on the table and examining it, when you see the study of religion actually as something about doing life, then actually you have to open up the range of things you're willing to look at. Okay, well, last thing is just to say, one other approach you could take is that if you see the study of religion as something that comes out of modernity, if you accept the idea that maybe it isn't an ancient thing that happens everywhere, but it results from the modern situation of plurality, dealing with other perspectives, and of a certain amount of secularism, saying I can stand outside of and between, or at least between those perspectives, maybe we should look at contemporary people. Perhaps we shouldn't be looking at Shankara. Perhaps we should be looking at people in other cultures, but in the modern context. So, for instance, perhaps in India, people like Vivekananda and Gandhi, who are seen as, in some ways, bad Hindu theologians because they're recreating Hinduism according to their own preferences. In some ways, these are people who were precisely rejected because they put Hinduism into more universal terms. Maybe instead of seeing them as bad Hindus, we should see them as good theorists of religion. They're trying to extend what they have and create a theory, in a sense, that it can apply to religion as a whole. Yes, it's a very particular theory that they have a vested interest in shaping, but that was certainly true of Freud, certainly true of Marx, and certainly true of Otto, so why complain about it in them if we're still reading those other people as canonical? Maybe they too, in a similar way, have a prejudice, but pertinent and useful and insightful thing to say about what religion is. You could do the same thing in, I think, other contexts. You know, look at Wahhabi Islam, look at Ismaili Islam, the way that Islam has produced kind of enlightenment, as it were, forms that are very aware of the question of what is religion, how should it be done, how should we read texts. These are very modern approaches. These are very much the kind of questions that gave rise to the concept of religion in the West. And perhaps they ought to be paid more attention to rather than thought of as slightly bad theologians or you know, very involved theologians in some way. You know, Hasidic piety, the Dalai Lama. All of these people potentially have something to say that is about understanding religion in modernity, but it hasn't necessarily been seen in that way. So I'm going to leave it at that because it's the end of the hour. But I do encourage the idea that we try and reform the study of religion from within religious studies. I think if we just keep doing Christianity applied to other religions, that's not much good. And it's also silly because it gives other people... It means the theologians, in a sense, will always have the upper hand. And the religious studies people will always be at a disadvantage because we're using someone else's tools and, you know, dealing someone else's deck, as it were.